Chapter 1. The Beginning of Business. On May 31, 1921, the Ford Motor Company turned out car number 5 million. It is out in my museum, along with the gasoline buggy that I began work on 30 years before, and which first ran satisfactorily along in the spring of 1893. I was running it when the bobolinks came to Dearborn, and they always come on April 2nd. There is all the difference in the world in the appearance of the two vehicles, and almost as much difference in construction and materials. But in fundamentals the two are curiously alike, except that the old buggy has on it a few wrinkles that we have not quite adopted in our modern car. For that first car, or buggy, even though it had but two cylinders, would make 20 miles an hour and run 60 miles on the 3 gallons of gas the little tank held, and is as good today as the day it was built. The development in methods of manufacture and in materials has been greater than the development in basic design. The whole design has been refined. The present Ford car, which is the Model T, has 4 cylinders and a self-starter. It is in every way a more convenient and an easier riding car. It is simpler than the first car, but almost every point in it may be found also in the first car. The changes have been brought about through experience in the making and not through any change in the basic principle, which I take to be an important fact, demonstrating that, given a good idea to start with, it is better to concentrate on perfecting it than to hunt around for a new idea. One idea at a time is about as much as anyone can handle. It was life on the farm that drove me into devising ways and means to better transportation. I was born on July 30, 1863, on a farm at Dearborn, Michigan, and my earliest recollection is that, considering the results, there was too much work on the place. That's the way I still feel about farming. There's a legend that my parents were very poor and that the early days were hard ones. Well, certainly they were not rich, but neither were they poor. As Michigan farmers went, we were prosperous. The house in which I was born is still standing, and it and the farm are part of my present holding. There was too much hard hand labor on our own and all the other farms at the time. Even when I was very young, I suspected that much might somehow be done in a better way. That's what took me into mechanics, although my mother always said that I was born a mechanic. I had a kind of workshop with odds and ends of metal for tools before I had anything else. In those days, we didn't have the toys of today. What we had were homemade. My toys were all tools, and they still are. And every fragment of machinery was a treasure. The biggest event of those early years was meeting with a road engine about 8 miles out of Detroit one day when we were driving to town. I was then 12 years old. The second biggest event was getting a watch, which happened in the same year. I remember that engine as though I'd seen it only yesterday, for it was the first vehicle other than horse-drawn that I'd ever seen. It was intended primarily for driving threshing machines and sawmills and was simply a portable engine and boiler mounted on wheels with a water tank and coal cart trailing behind. I had seen plenty of these engines hauled around by horses, but this one had a chain that made a connection between the engine and the rear wheels of the wagon-like frame on which the boiler was mounted. The engine was placed over the boiler, and one man standing on the platform behind the boiler shoveled coal, managed the throttle, and did the steering. It had been made by Nichols, Shepherd, and Company of Battle Creek. I found that out at once. The engine had stopped to let us pass with our horses, and I was off the wagon and talking to the engineer before my father, who was driving, knew what I was up to. The engineer was very glad to explain the whole affair. He was proud of it. He showed me how the chain was disconnected from the propelling wheel and a belt put on to drive other machinery. He told me that the engine made 200 revolutions a minute and that the chain pinion could be shifted to let the wagon stop while the engine was still running. This last is a feature which, although in different fashion, is incorporated into modern automobiles. It was not important with steam engines, which are easily stopped and started, but it became very important with the gasoline engine. It was that engine which took me into automotive transportation. I tried to make models of it, and some years later I did make one that ran very well, but from the time I saw that road engine as a boy of 12 right forward to today, my great interest has been in making a machine that would travel the roads. Driving to town, I always had a pocket full of trinkets, nuts, washers, and odds and ends of machinery. Often I took a broken watch and tried to put it together. When I was 13, I managed for the first time to put a watch together so that it would keep time. By the time I was 15, I could do almost anything in watch repairing, although my tools were of the crudest. There was an immense amount to be learned simply by tinkering with things. It's not possible to learn from books how everything is made, and a real mechanic ought to know how nearly everything is made. Machines are to a mechanic what books are to a writer. He gets ideas from them, and if he has any brains, he'll apply those ideas. From the beginning, I never could work up much interest in the labor of farming. I wanted to have something to do with machinery. My father was not entirely in sympathy with my bent toward mechanics. He thought that I ought to be a farmer. When I left school at 17 and became an apprentice in the machine shop of the dry dock engine works, I was all but given up for lost. I passed my apprenticeship without trouble. That is, I was qualified to be a machinist long before my 3-year term had expired, and having a liking for fine work and a leaning toward watches, I worked nights at repairing in a jewelry shop. At one period of those early days, I think I must have had fully 300 watches. I thought that I could build a serviceable watch for around 30 cents and nearly started in business. But I didn't, because I figured out that watches were not universal necessities, and therefore people generally would not buy them. Just how I reached that surprising conclusion, I'm unable to state. I didn't like the ordinary jewelry and watchmaking work, excepting where the work was hard to do. Even then, I wanted to make something in quantity. It was just about the time when the standard railroad time was being arranged. We had formerly been on sun time, and for quite a while, just as in our present daylight savings days, the railroad time differed from the local time. That bothered me a good deal, and so I succeeded in making a watch that kept both times. It had two dials, and it was quite a curiosity in the neighborhood. In 1879, that is about 4 years after I first saw that Nichols Shepherd machine, I managed to get a chance to run one, and when my apprenticeship was over, I worked with a local representative of the Westinghouse Company of Schenectady as an expert in the setting up and repair of their road engines. The engine they put out was much the same as the Nichols Shepherd engine, excepting that the engine was up front, the boiler in the rear, and the power was applied to the back wheels by a belt. They could make 12 miles an hour on the road, even though the self-propelling feature was only an incident of the construction. They were sometimes used as tractors to pull heavy loads, and if the owner also happened to be in the threshing machine business, he hitched his threshing machine and other paraphernalia to the engine in moving from farm to farm. What bothered me was the weight and the cost. They weighed a couple of tons and were far too expensive to be owned by other than a farmer with a great deal of land. They were mostly employed by people who went into threshing as a business or who had sawmills or some other line that required portable power. Even before that time, I had the idea of making some kind of a light steam car that would take the place of horses, more especially, however, as a tractor to attend to the excessively hard labor of plowing. It occurred to me, as I remember somewhat vaguely, that precisely the same idea might be applied to a carriage or a wagon on the road, A horseless carriage was a common idea. People had been talking about carriages without horses for many years back. In fact, ever since the steam engine was invented. But the idea of the carriage at first did not seem so practical to me as the idea of an engine to do the harder farm work. And of all the work on the farm, plowing was the hardest. Our roads were poor, and we had not the habit of getting around. One of the most remarkable features of the automobile on the farm is the way that it has broadened the farmer's life. We simply took for granted that unless the errand were urgent, we would not go to town, and I think we rarely made more than a trip a week. In bad weather, we did not go even that often. Being a full-fledged machinist and with a very fair workshop on the farm, it was not difficult for me to build a steam wagon or tractor. In the building of it came the idea that perhaps it might be made for road use. I felt perfectly certain that horses, considering all the bother of attending them and the expense of feeding, did not earn their keep. The obvious thing to do was to design and build a steam engine that would be light enough to run an ordinary wagon or to pull a plow. I thought it more important first to develop the tractor, to lift farm drudgery off flesh and blood and lay it on steel and motors, has been my most constant ambition. It was circumstances that took me first into the actual manufacture of road cars. I found eventually that people were more interested in something that would travel on the road than in something that would do the work on the farms. In fact, I doubt that the light farm tractor would have been introduced on the farm had not the farmer had his eyes opened slowly but surely by the automobile. But that is getting ahead of the story. I thought the farmer would be more interested in the tractor. I built a steam car that ran. It had a kerosene-heated boiler and developed plenty of power and a neat control, which is so easy with a steam throttle. But the boiler was dangerous. To get the requisite power without too big and heavy a power plant required that the engine work under high pressure. Sitting on a high-pressure steam boiler is not altogether pleasant. To make it even reasonably safe required an excess of weight that nullified the economy of the high pressure. For 2 years I kept experimenting with various sorts of boilers. The engine and control problems were simple enough, and then I definitely abandoned the whole idea of running a road vehicle by steam. I knew that in England they had what amounted to locomotives running on the roads, hauling lines of trailers, and also there was no difficulty in designing a big steam tractor for use on a large farm. But ours were not then English roads. They would have stalled or racked to pieces the strongest and heaviest road tractor. And anyway, the manufacturing of a big tractor, which only a few wealthy farmers could buy, did not seem to me worthwhile. But I did not give up the idea of a horseless carriage. The work with the Westinghouse representative only served to confirm the opinion I had formed that steam was not suitable for light vehicles. That's why I stayed only a year with that company. There was nothing more that the big steam tractors and engines could teach me, and I didn't want to waste time on something that would lead nowhere. A few years before, it was while I was an apprentice, I read in the World of Science, an English publication, of the silent gas engine, which was then coming out in England. I think it was the Otto engine. It ran with illuminating gas, had a single large cylinder, and the power impulses being thus intermittent, required an extremely heavy flywheel. As far as weight was concerned, it gave nothing like the power per pound of metal that a steam engine gave, and the use of illuminating gas seemed to dismiss it as even a possibility for road use. It was interesting to me only as all machinery was interesting. I followed in the English and American magazines, which we got in the shop, the development of the engine, and most particularly the hints of the possible replacement of the illuminating gas fuel by a gas formed by the vaporization of gasoline. The idea of gas engines was by no means new, but this was the first time that a really serious effort had been made to put them on the market. They were received with interest rather than enthusiasm, and I do not recall any one who thought that the internal combustion engine could ever have more than a limited use. All the wise people demonstrated conclusively that the engine could not compete with steam. They never thought that it might carve out a career for itself. That's the way with wise people. They're so wise and practical that they always know to a dot just why something cannot be done. They always know the limitations. That's why I never employ an expert in full bloom. If ever I wanted to kill opposition by unfair means, I would endow the opposition with experts. They would have so much good advice that I could be sure they would do little work. The gas engine interested me, and I followed its progress, but only from curiosity, until about 1885 or 1886, when the steam engine, being discarded as the motive power for the carriage that I intended someday to build, I had to look around for another sort of motive power. In 1885, I repaired an auto engine at the Eagle Iron Works in Detroit. No one in town knew anything about them. There was a rumor that I did, and although I had never before been in contact with one, I undertook and carried through the job. That gave me a chance to study the new engine at first hand, and in 1887, I built one on the auto four-cycle model just to see if I understood the principles. Four-cycle means that the piston traverses the cylinder four times to get one power impulse. The first stroke draws in the gas, the second compresses it, the third is the explosion or power stroke, while the fourth stroke exhausts the waste gas. The little model worked well enough. It had a 1-inch bore and a 3-inch stroke, operated with gasoline, and while it didn't develop much power, it was slightly lighter in proportion than the engines being offered commercially. I gave it away later to a young man who wanted it for something or other, and whose name I've forgotten. It was eventually destroyed. That was the beginning of the work with the internal combustion engine. I was then on the farm to which I had returned, more because I wanted to experiment than because I wanted a farm, and now being an all-around machinist, I had a first-class workshop to replace the toy shop of earlier days. My father offered me 40 acres of timberland, provided I gave up being a machinist. I agreed in a provisional way, for cutting the timber gave me a chance to get married. I fitted out a sawmill and a portable engine and started to cut out and saw up the timber on the tract. Some of the first of that lumber went into a cottage on my new farm, and in it we began our married life. It wasn't a big house, 31 feet square, and only a story and a half high, but it was a comfortable place. I added to it my workshop, and when I was not cutting timber, I was working on the gas engines, learning what they were and how they acted. I read everything I could find, but the greatest knowledge came from the work. A gas engine is a mysterious sort of thing. It will not always go the way it should. You can imagine how those first engines acted. It was in 1890 that I began on a double-cylinder engine. It was quite impractical to consider the single cylinder for transportation purposes. The flywheel had to be entirely too heavy. Between making the first four-cycle engine of the auto type and the start on a double cylinder, I had made a great many experimental engines out of tubing. I fairly knew my way about. The double cylinder I thought could be applied to a road vehicle, and my original idea was to put it on a bicycle with a direct connection to the crankshaft, and allowing for the rear wheel of the bicycle to act as the balance wheel. The speed was going to be varied only by the throttle. I never carried out this plan because it soon became apparent that the engine, gasoline tank, and the various necessary controls would be entirely too heavy for a bicycle. The plan of the two opposed cylinders was that while one would be delivering power, the other would be exhausting. This naturally would not require so heavy a flywheel to even the application of power. The work started in my shop on the farm. Then I was offered a job with the Detroit Electric Company as an engineer and machinist at $45 a month. I took it because that was more money than the farm was bringing me, and I had decided to get away from farm life anyway. The timber had all been cut. We rented a house on Bagley Avenue, Detroit. The workshop came along, and I set it up in a brick shed at the back of the house. During the first several months, I was in the night shift at the electric light plant, which gave me very little time for experimenting, but after that I was in the day shift, and every night and all of every Saturday night I worked on the new motor. I cannot say that it was hard work. No work with interest is ever hard. I always am certain of results. They always come if you work hard enough. But it was a very great thing to have my wife even more confident than I was. She's always been that way. I had to work from the ground up. That is, although I knew that a number of people were working on horseless carriages, I could not know what they were doing. The hardest problems to overcome were in the making and breaking of the spark and in the avoidance of excess weight. For the transmission, the steering gear, and the general construction, I could draw on my experience with the steam tractors. In 1892, I completed my first motor car, but it was not until the spring of the following year that it ran to my satisfaction. The first car had something of the appearance of a buggy. There were two cylinders with a 2.5-inch bore and a 6-inch stroke set side by side and over the rear axle. I made them out of the exhaust pipe of a steam engine that I had bought. They developed about 4 horsepower. The power was transmitted from the motor to the countershaft by a belt and from the countershaft to the rear wheel by a chain. The car would hold 2 people, the seat being suspended on posts and the body on elliptical springs. There were 2 speeds, one of 10 and the other of 20 miles per hour, obtained by shifting the belt, which was done by a clutch lever in front of the driving seat. Thrown forward, the lever put in the high speed. Thrown back, the low speed. With the lever upright, the engine could run free. To start the car, it was necessary to turn the motor over by hand with the clutch free. To stop the car, one simply released the clutch and applied the foot brake. There was no reverse, and speeds other than those of the belt were obtained by the throttle. I bought the ironwork for the frame of the carriage and also the seat and the springs. The wheels were 28-inch wire bicycle wheels with rubber tires. The balance wheel I had cast from a pattern that I had made, and all of the more delicate mechanism I made myself. One of the features that I discovered necessary was a compensating gear that permitted the same power to be applied to each of the rear wheels when turning corners. The machine altogether weighed about 500 pounds. A tank under the seat held 3 gallons of gasoline, which was fed to the motor through a small pipe and a mixing valve. The ignition was by electric spark. The original machine was air-cooled, or, to be more accurate, the motor simply was not cooled at all. I found that on a run of an hour or more, the motor heated up, and so I very shortly put a water jacket around the cylinders and piped it to a tank in the rear of the car over the cylinders. Nearly all of these various features had been planned in advance. That's the way I've always worked. I draw a plan and work out every detail on the plan before starting to build. For otherwise, one will waste a great deal of time in makeshifts as the work goes on, and the finished article will not have coherence. It will not be rightly proportioned. Many inventors fail because they don't distinguish between planning and experimenting. The largest building difficulties that I had were in obtaining the proper materials. The next were with tools. There had to be some adjustments and changes in details of the design, but what held me up most was that I had neither the time nor the money to search for the best material for each part. But in the spring of 1893, the machine was running to my partial satisfaction and giving an opportunity further to test out the design and material on the road.